Case number 04-1335 et al. Braintree Electric Light Department et al. Petitioners versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Mr. Coyle for the petitioners, Ms. Pexella for the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, John Coyle of the firm Duncan & Allen on behalf of the Braintree Electric Light Department, Reading Municipal Light Department, and Taunton Municipal Lighting Plant. This case presents, I think, three broad issues for the court's consideration. First, whether the FERC's determination that allowing ISO New England to include lobbying costs in its rates is just and reasonable, whether that decision is supported by reasoned decision-making and substantial evidence. Second, whether the Commission's approval of compelled subsidization of ISO New England's lobbying and promotional activities by dissenting customers contravenes the First Amendment. And third, whether the Commission unreasonably limited its already limited prophylactic remedy, that is, the disclosure of lobbying contacts by ISO New England, by permitting ISO New England not to post information about contacts, that the ISO deems to be informational or educational in nature, which, as the record discloses, covers their version of everything they do. I'd like to start with the statutory issue, the just and reasonable issue.
Before you do that, could I ask you to respond to the agency's argument that you've waived your challenge to the 2005 rate?
Yes, Your Honor. I think fairly stated, we have not, because these cases should be seen as a continuum. I looked at the agency's request for a voluntary remand on the 2006 case as, in substance, a confession of error with respect to what it had done in 2005. The evidence that we brought forward in the 2006 case ultimately led the agency to conclude that there were factual issues here that required resolution on an evidentiary record of some sort. And the agency's contrary holding with respect to the 2005 rate case obviously can't stand in light of that concession. So
are you asking any remedy that turns on 05?
Not in particular, Your Honor.
I thought you were asking remedies going forward.
Yeah. What's really at issue here is a question of principle. The FERC has disclaimed.
Well, we don't do principles here.
Sorry, Your Honor. Let me be more precise. As Judge Edwards says, precision works. The FERC has disclaimed any intention of providing refunds, and we're not here seeking refunds for the 05 case, to be precise about the answer. That doesn't mean we've waived the argument with respect to deficiencies in the FERC's order, but there is no specific relief associated with that case that we're seeking here.
In fact, if you prevail, would it have any effect on the rates? if these costs, expenses, are in fact not recoverable, would it affect the rates at all?
The rates are determined for the ISO on a year-by-year basis, and so if it were determined that our position is correct, there may be an effect on prospective rates. But these issues, for example, have not been raised with respect to the rates currently in effect for the 2008
calendar. Just imagining if these costs were not recoverable, would they have had an effect on the 2005-2006 rates? I'm getting at this is, from what I can tell, this is de minimis, right?
De minimis is a two-edged sword in this context, Your Honor, as we point out in the brief. I can't tell you precisely numerically whether there would have been an impact on the rate levels or not. There's approximately $2 million total at issue in connection with these activities every year. And over the relevant period, the ISO's operational budget has been in the neighborhood of $128 million. So you, if
what does the operations mean?
As opposed to its capital budget, Your Honor, the,
is everything but capital?
Yes.
But that doesn't involve, I guess, it doesn't purchase and resell, it just...
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right. Okay.
They expend capital for buildings and computer systems and things like that, but we're talking here about an annual operational budget, which goes for personnel, consulting, lobbyists, et cetera.
Come on, give me a statutory argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. There are really two fundamental problems with the Commission's finding that it was just and reasonable to include these costs and rates. The first is that the decision rests ultimately and substantially on a fiction. The fiction which finds its purest assertion at paragraph 21 of the order on rehearing of the paper hearing case, where the Commission says ISO has no interest in obtaining a profit from its operations and seeks only to provide reliable service at the lowest reasonable cost. There is no...
Break that down. The first clause is correct, isn't it?
They don't have
it
a profit motive. It's a not-for-profit corporation.
It's the second clause that bothers you.
Or even part of the second clause, at the lowest reasonable cost, is the part that I'm taking exception to as having no foundation and being, in fact, premised on a fiction, and a fiction that this court in the NSTAR Electric and Gas Company case...
You're reading the order fairly, though. I mean, it seems to me FERC based their decision on a determination that these particular costs were legitimate. They were, you know, educational, informational, or where they were lobbying regarding the core operational activities. That's fairly read there. What they're saying now. Now, to be sure, they buttress that argument by saying this is a not-for-profit entity that's acting in folks' best interests.
But I'm not sure, Your Honor. Well, in fact, I am sure that you cannot parse the order as the Commission urges you to. There is no evidentiary basis, no reliable evidentiary basis for doing that, which gets to my second point. what you have here is an undependably, unreliably truncated evidentiary record. And let me point out two sort of basic failings that we dwell on in the brief. There is an admission of record in the form of the ISO's income tax returns, federal income tax returns. They're a 501c3 organization. They are required to report on their Form 990s direct lobbying expenditures.
But it seems to me that the very order that sets up whatever it is, account 426-4,
yes,
makes clear that that account itself, which has some relationship with the income tax issue of lobbying, is not dispositive for whether it can be charged to ratepayers.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. Account 426.4 is, you're exactly right, not dispositive of the question of whether or not lobbying expenditures are recoverable in rates. However, the factual issue that I'm discussing here is a little bit different in the sense that what I have on an evidentiary record is, in effect, an admission that there were at least some direct lobbying expenditures. And then I go to the submittal that the ISO was permitted to make by the FERC, some 800 pages of affidavits and attachments that say, we never lobby. Okay? Everybody has to be somewhere. None of the affiants admitted to having engaged in any lobbying activities over the relevant period, but some dollars show up on the tax return as having been expended for that purpose. FERC goes on to say, well, even if they were, we find that that's acceptable. How can you find that since you don't know what filter the ISO was applying to what universe of activities to distill down $2 million worth of budget to $11,000 in 2006, the first 6 months of 2006? of direct lobbying expenditures. Don't think it would have been a problem if we'd had discovery in an evidentiary hearing, but we didn't. That was the FERC's choice.
I mean, I guess one difficulty with what you're saying is that we have, according to what you say, a conflict in what the ISO said, conflict in things that it said, internal conflict, on a point that is really not relevant, the classification, whether these are called lobbying or not.
I disagree with that, Your Honor, that it's not relevant to the classification. I think it's highly relevant because the definition of...
They have to be reasonable and germane, right?
Germane gets us into the first...
Germane and reasonable lobbying.
Germane gets us into the First Amendment.
The First Amendment seems to me really quick. Doesn't Jackson dispose of that completely?
It does not, Your Honor.
Why not?
To give you a really quick answer, Jackson involves a holding that the approval of a tariff doesn't constitute state action. What you have in this case is a direct government agency approval of the recovery of these specific costs over the...
Tariffs are approvals of charges, right? I mean, that's the agency action on the tariff is approval of a charge.
Your Honor, what you have here and what distinguishes this case from Jackson is the direct approval over objection of expenditures for these purposes. There is no purer form of state action than that. That is exactly the form of...
You mean by that standard, approval of a tariff is a pure form of state action because under the law, until it's approved, the firm can't sell.
With respect, Your Honor, there is a significant difference between Jackson and this case. And the significant difference is, if you'll recall, that in Jackson, the complaining party was saying that they were entitled to a hearing before their electric service was cut off. They had a due process right to a hearing before their electric service was cut off because the Public Service Commission of, I think it was the state of Pennsylvania, had approved the tariff under which the cutoff was being done. The relationship in that case between the action of the state and its operation on an individual or a party is not nearly as direct as it is in this case where my clients are dissenting from paying these expenses.
I really don't understand that. Here, the commission approves a charge of what seems to be, you know, a very small amount on the scale of the whole thing. And in Jackson, electricity is cut off absolutely with the authorization of the state. So, I mean, if the distinction is in terms of impact.
I don't think it is. I don't think I said that.
Well, I'm sorry, but then I was.
I think what I'm saying is that what the governmental action here is directly saying over the objection of a litigant in a specific case that it is all right to charge these charges. Jackson involves a very different setup of a generic mode of dealing with utility cutoffs, the specific operation of which was...
Jackson would come out differently if the regulator there had said you should come before us and before you actually cut off, and we'll say yes or no, and let's assume it did that without the ordinary procedures required for if the government were doing it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
Is there any language in the opinion that supports that reading?
Excuse me?
Is there any language in the Jackson opinion that supports that reading? It seemed to me that Jackson opinion looked at the basic structure between what the firm was doing and what the regulator was doing, and said just authorizing something is not enough, even if it's a monopoly, a state-created monopoly.
In fact, let me ask you this. Yeah. Jackson says, where the commission has not put its own weight on the side of the proposed practice by ordering it,
right,
does not translate a practice initiated by the utility into state action. I mean, Jackson seems to require far more. It's not approval, it's ordering of an action.
I think that the language that you've just read, Your Honor, supports my point, but I'd go further and say if you want to look for the correct analogy between regulatory action and the state action involved in this case, it's the Pacific Gas and Electric case, where the regulatory commission is ordering the utility to communicate with its customers through the inclusion of third-party materials in its bills.
Now, your argument there is that it was so clear that the court didn't even have to discuss it in state action terms.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. I think that's correct, and I think that's the reason I rely on the Hurley case. You have an injunction in that case. You have the action of a court upholding the principle. That is state action.
What do we do? I mean, how should we think about Abood and Keller? How do you bring them in? I mean, it seems to me in looking at these cases, there's, and I think you're implicitly arguing, there's the courts seem to be shading a little bit differently and express, and the concerns are more open. We're talking about First Amendment or alleged First Amendment rights. Pacific Gas, Keller, Abood, seem to me quite different from the first case you were talking about. But tell me what your take is on it.
Well, my take on Keller and Abood, if I may be permitted to finish the answer despite the red light, my take on Abood in particular is that it controls this case. You have a governmentally compelled involuntary association, and you have the participant in that association being compelled to provide financial support for the expression of views with which he disagrees. The holding in Abood is that in those circumstances, the First Amendment requires that the dissenting participant be given an opportunity to opt out of those expenses.
There's no First Amendment interest in Jackson, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Jackson was a due process case.
I mean, that's my concern here, and I'll hear what the other side has to say, that the line of authorities in the First Amendment, the tax seems to be quite different, as was my colleague's dissent in the RFRA case, the FAA case. So go ahead, finish up.
At the root of it, what you have here, and I think is a common solution for both problems. The issue is whether you decide to resolve the case on the basis of the regulatory issue solely, or also on the basis of the First Amendment issue. The key to this is disclosure. As Justice Brandeis observed, sunlight is the best of disinfectants. FERC started put one foot on the right road by imposing a disclosure condition. What you would need to make that condition conform to the requirements of the First Amendment is also a meaningful opportunity to opt out of paying those charges from which you dissent. And FERC nowhere provided that. So its solution is constitutionally deficient. However,
arguing at bottom that as a regulatory matter, lobbying expenses should never be allowed?
No.
Germane or not?
No, Your Honor. But we didn't get that far in this case. The evidentiary record developed did not permit, in my view at least, the development of an appropriate evidentiary basis on germaneness. Again, if you're going to take on the First Amendment.
Your argument is that FERC, the other side, puts in 800 pages and says nothing in here is lobbying. FERC doesn't split it out in any way, but acknowledges there's probably some stuff in there that's lobbying, but we're not going to sort it out. And so your argument is on that record, you cannot possibly determine what's germane because you haven't looked to see what was lobbying. Is that it or not? I'm trying to understand your theory.
I think that's a big part of it. I think that's not all of it, Your Honor. I mean, this is a case where, on balance, the FERC having decided to proceed by paper hearing, which it has virtually unlimited discretion to do, they cannot then turn around and fault my side of the litigation for saying, well, you didn't prove this, you didn't prove that, you didn't prove the other thing. I had the record that the FERC was willing to allow to be developed. That record has a number of significant gaps in it, one of which, apart from the tax reports, the tax returns on lobbying activities that everybody denies having engaged in, is a conflict between a lobbying disclosure form by one of the lobbyists that says they lobby the FERC, and FERC's position that says, well, all of our contacts would necessarily be regulatory in nature and entitled to recovery under Account 921 of the Uniform System of Accounts, where this court, I think, an Electric Power Supply Association has identified at least one and possibly more than one circumstances where that argument doesn't wash. I didn't have any opportunity to explore that either. So we have a conflicting evidentiary record that FERC has simply pronounced a blessing over, saying, well, it's good enough. And I don't think that they're permitted to do that under either the Constitution or the statute.
They failed to give any reasoned analysis of the record that points to germaneness. Is that what you're saying? In other words, where there is lobbying, they haven't parsed the record in the way that would convince any reasonable persons one way or another as to what was and was not germane?
I think that's a fair summary, Your Honor, because where we end up on germaneness is this canard, if you will, that because they're a nonprofit, they always act in the interest of all their constituents, which...
That's definitely not... First place, it's not an accurate formulation of what the Commission says, because the Commission acknowledges quite explicitly that the constituents may well have conflicting interests, and the best you can hope is that the ISO overall tries to enhance the interests of the constituents.
Your Honor,
totally unrealistic to say anything more, and although there may be some unrealistic language in what the Commission says, I don't think they go much beyond a test saying overall improvement of the interests of the constituents.
With respect, Your Honor, I think that what they said runs afoul of this Court's decision in the NSTAR electric and gas case, in that it rests on the unsupported assumption that the ISO is motivated to do things at the lowest cost, when in fact there is no support for that notion anywhere in this record or any other, as far as I'm aware. I thank the Court.
Okay, thank you.
Can I move the microphone?
What does the sign say? I think it says don't move it.
I don't see one anymore. That's why I was asking. It's just really close.
There you go.
Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. Beth Pacella for FERC. I'll start off talking about the Commission's findings that all of the expenditures were recoverable because they were directly related to the ISO's core mission. And the mission identified by the Commission and relied on was twofold, that the ISO is to develop, oversee, and fairly administer New England's wholesale electric markets, and secondarily, to ensure the reliable operation of New England's bulk electric power system. So that's the mission that the Commission was focused on, and that's the mission that the extensive record here addressed. And
well, if you don't isolate out what is and is not lobbying, and then determine which among the lobbying expenses are germane as opposed to too far-reaching, that's just conclusive.
The commission, Your Honor, found that they were all germane. If you look at the evidentiary record, which I spent a lot of time on this weekend, and I have to say it takes a really long time. There's a lot in there. It's absolutely untrue that the ISO did not admit to lobbying. They time and time again.
Wait, say that again. I didn't hear
you. It's not true what petitioners assert now, unlike in their brief, that the ISO didn't admit to lobbying. The 800-page document is replete with instances.
Well, there's no question about that. That isn't my question.
So what they did was they went through, for example, if you pick if you look at, for example, at the federal level in the filing, in the paper hearing that the ISO submitted, they talk in for every specific jurisdiction, federal and each of the states in New England, they talk about the non-legislative contacts that they had with public entities, and they also talk about the legislative topics. So, for example, at JA... In the ISO New England's brief at JA 1031 and in Ms. O'Connor's affidavit at paragraph 68 at JA 1072-73, they specifically list, we talked to legislators about the Energy Policy Act of 2005, specifically the native load protection, participant funding requirements, need for mandatory enforceable electric reliability standards, locational install capacity, and they explain in detail why they spoke about each of those items. For example, regarding the locational installed capacity, they had a need to address the looming capacity problems in New England. That's specifically stated again at the brief at
Where does FERC take these lobbying efforts, admitted lobbying efforts, and say, in all these instances, these are permissible and germane? Or are they simply saying, because the ISO asserts that it's acting in the common interest, that overarching notion essentially says that lobbying's okay,
if you look
as long as it relates to our their region?
No, that's not at all the Commission's holding. The Commission's holding,
understand.
If you look at JA 2035, which is 118 FERC, at note 23, for example, the Commission says lobbying expenses are recoverable from ratepayers upon a sufficient showing that they're directly related to or to existing or future operations, are undertaken for the collective interest of market participants, are in furtherance of legitimate RTO objectives, and are not for the personal benefit of the company officials or agents. So the Commission has now set out the standard. And then at in that same order, at paragraph 17, JA 2034-35, the Commission explicitly said ISO New England's communications were, first it says, we've thoroughly looked at the record. We've examined the explanations supported, provided by the ISO, as well as the information arguments filed by the other parties. And we find that the communications were either educational and informational in nature, or in instances where they were lobbying, they were directly related to ISO New England's existing or proposed core operations, the two matters that I mentioned before, their two missions, and undertaken in the collective interest of New England ratepayers.
See,
all of the all.
See, it's conclusory to me, and I'm thinking about Abood and like cases where the fight
the
is over. Let me finish. Tell you, I'm not even saying where the Abood is opposite. The collective interest, where does that get you? Because there are individual members of the group who say, yeah, we hear you, but we strongly oppose your message. What FERC has done here is to avoid the question.
No, you're
whereas
right.
The Abood analysis is, no, once you go to a place, you can claim it's in the collective interest, but there are people who strongly oppose that position. They can't be required to pay for that message.
In Abood, for example, Your Honor, in the union fees case, the record was replete with evidence, and the union admitted that they did all kinds of political activities.
Well, as is true here. The unions in most of those cases, and where they lose now, I'm talking about the Abood line of cases.
Yes, that's
there are lots of union Abood-type cases where the unions argue, with very convincingly, Supreme Court has said it doesn't matter how convincing it is, we're not letting you cross the line. Very convincingly, that what they are doing advances the common good of their collective units. That is, they are lobbying, they are trying to get legislative agendas, trying to get certain individuals elected. I realize that's not involved here, but what they are arguing is the common good. And the court has essentially said that common good rationale doesn't cut it. You've got to do something more than that.
Your Honor, in Abood at page 234, the court said, appellants argue they may constitutionally prevent the union spending a part of their required fees to contribute to political candidates to express political views unrelated to the duties as exclusive bargaining representatives. And the evidence showed that that was true.
Counsel, what I'm telling you is if you follow the Abood line of cases through, and you look at what the courts have done, there isn't the slightest doubt that the unions have been prohibited from engaging in lobbying activities where they take legislative positions that they would argue, quite convincingly, serve the common good of their collective bargaining units and unions generally. And the courts have said
that's
not
true,
enough.
Your Honor, because
it
the
is
court,
true.
Well, that's why the remedy when there is a First Amendment violation is put in place, that you have to set aside, for example, money in advance, because they are definitively doing things, and the records in those cases show that there were matters that were not part of their specific, they were outside of collective bargaining. Collective bargaining is the mission of a union. That's the whole purpose of its creation, and there were things that they were doing outside of that.
We're going in circles because there are a number of union advocates would smile at your argument. That's a very narrow, naive view of what a collective bargaining agent does. What I'm saying, I agree, the court has said, but you can't go there.
Right.
And your large view is an accurate large view, but you still can't go there if there are members of that collective group who don't endorse what you're endorsing.
If it's outside of your mission, Your Honor, you're correct.
No, but what I'm trying, counsel, it is in their mission, broadly conceived, just as the ISO is arguing all kinds of things are within their mission under the collective good umbrella.
There's nothing that petitioners have pointed to.
All right, now, is that what we're coming to?
No, on this record,
that they failed as a matter of burden of proof?
No, what I'm saying is there's nothing, the record is what the record is, but there's nothing that they're pointing to say, okay, the commission found that locational install capacity is germane to their mission, and that's not true because, of course, it's germane to their mission. Locational install capacity, the whole purpose of it is reliability of the grid. That's clearly germane to their mission. Withdrawal of members from the ISO. Of course that's germane to the ISO's mission, because if members are withdrawing, how are they going to have efficient markets? Because they're not going to have supply available, and they're not going to have grid availability. So these are all matters. There's nothing in this record, on this record, which is extensive.
Educate me. Is there some mechanism for a constituent member of the ISO to complain about some lobbying strategy or some goal that the ISO undertakes?
The budget not only goes before FERC, but there's a budgeting process at the ISO itself, even before the filing is submitted to FERC. So absolutely, the types of things
there's a vote taken.
And
presumably, if it's not carried by a majority vote or some supermajority vote,
I don't know the specifics of that, but for sure there is a vote, and each of the filings in this case specified the percentage that supported the budgets that were proposed.
Just as they do in unions, they vote. And the minority members are still allowed to opt out on expenditures that they object to. And I think I heard you say there's a strong regulatory hand involved in all of this, right?
I don't remember saying that.
Well, you said FERC is involved continuously, and these matters come before FERC. No, did I just hear that?
FERC reviews it, as Judge Williams was pointing out. These are tariff filings, and so FERC reviews the tariff filings.
There's a strong regulatory hand involved.
I don't think the type that the Supreme Court is concerned about.
That wasn't my question. There's a strong regulatory hand here.
I think that's a...
They're very much beholden to FERC, and they report to FERC, and they have to be, all that they do has to be approved.
Right. FERC is very careful.
A very strong coercive regulatory hand.
No. Not well. I'm certainly not conceding.
A weak hand.
It's not coercive, Your Honor. I mean,
would we be accurate in writing an opinion and laying out the background to say really the ISOs are not much influenced by FERC? They pretty much operate independently, and that's the kind of
the budget
we're looking at.
Absolutely, and the
is that fair for us to say? Just answer my question, really. Is it fair? Would it be fair and accurate for us to say ISOs? Once they're created, they're on their own pretty much. And really,
of course that's not accurate. But what you're saying is different, Your Honor. What FERC did
what
nothing here.
I said was what I just said.
But no, you said coercive. FERC is being coercive, and FERC has a heavy hand. And that's different. It's just doing its normal regulatory.
But that doesn't mean your hand isn't heavy because you're doing what you do routinely. What
FERC
you do routinely may be with a heavy hand.
Your Honor, FERC did not tell the ISO to go to Congress and lobby. There's no allegation
but
that that's
FERC says whether or not going to Congress is permissible.
Just as it does with any rates.
Okay.
It's just a
rate,
simple rate approval matter. The commission also addressed the First Amendment matters, setting out the standards. It said, as Your Honors have noted, Jackson really controls this case. That's what the commission said as well.
Judge Edwards raises a fair point that appear to be somewhat different rules for the First Amendment, for a First Amendment claim.
The First Amendment standards, Your Honor, is, again, mere approval or acquiescence is no question, is not, which is what occurred here, is not sufficient to hold the government responsible for those initiatives. And that's what I was just talking about a minute ago as well. Even where there's extensive government regulation of private activity, the Supreme Court explained in American Manufacturers, the Supreme Court has consistently held the mere fact that a business is regulated and does not convert its action, which it chose to do, it chose to go and bring these matters up to Congress, that does not make that the government's responsibility. And again, you have to show that there is a sufficiently close nexus between the government and the challenged action. So there would have to be a showing that the commission told the ISO, you go.
That is not the test in the First Amendment cases. That is just absolutely sure. That's what something, Keller says?
Something that, well, it comes right out of Bloom.
Is that what Keller says?
The quote in Bloom
that
is.
That the state had to tell the Bar Association, you have to go to the legislature?
No, the difference, and again, no Your Honor, I think in Keller, the concern was there were matters that are perfectly fine within the Bar Association's mission.
And the reason the state was involved there is because it was a state-required Bar Association. But the Bar Association, the state wasn't telling the Bar Association where to lobby or not to lobby or what positions to take.
No, that's a different circumstance, Your Honor. The Bar Association's mission was, quote, to promote the improvement of the administration of justice. So, for example, certain of the things they were doing, like lobbying regarding requesting Congress to refrain from enacting a guest worker program. The court lists that at page 15 in that case. They were funding gun control initiatives. They were endorsing a nuclear weapons freeze. I mean, those things had nothing to do with the mission of, again, promoting the improvement in the administration of justice. Here,
I think we just talked past one another. I'm talking about whether or not this organization would be viewed as covered by state action. You're talking about whether the activities are permissible or impermissible.
Well, because the commission held that even if what the commission did were state action, these would not be one First Amendment issues because the activities of the ISO all were germane to its specific mission, which is stated in its tariff. So I'm not talking past you. They're just separate parts of a test. And so if you're not satisfied that we meet the first part, FERC was happy to move on to the second part and created a hearing so that there would be an extensive record, which there is, which satisfies the standards here, all of the standards here, both the commission's first holding and the First Amendment holding as well. If there are no further questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Does Mr. Coyle have any time? Mr. Coyle, will give you a minute.
Did you contest with any particularity any of the purported findings on the lobbying activity as being outside of a permissible category?
I think the fair answer to that question, Your Honor, is specifically no. However, at pages 24 to 25 of our initial brief in the statement of facts, what you will see is a list of FERC cases in which Ms. O'Connor, the ISO New England's affiant, had said that the ISO had taken a position. And one of those cases had to do with mergers of ISOs. I'd also, so there is a list in there where we expressed doubt. Is it specifically taking issue? No. The business about the core mission, if I could, rests on what FERC has elsewhere described in its order approving the Regional Transmission Organization for New England as a briefly summarized non-comprehensive set of guidelines and principles selected for inclusion by the parties as RTO objectives. It hardly qualifies as a mission. I wanted briefly to address Judge Edwards' point about the coercive regulatory hand. Unlike many other contexts, there is no opportunity to withhold disputed funding from your ISO bill. Under the ISO tariff, if you don't pay the bill in full, when do your services cut off? And finally, the point about the nexus between government and the challenged action, I'd invite the court's attention to the ISO's brief at page 20, where the ISO says, several of the proposals the municipal's brief identifies as controversial were undertaken by the ISO simply because it was directed to do so by FERC or because it was in furtherance of or to implement established FERC policy. I think that, if nothing else, and there is plenty else in the record, establishes the requisite nexus. If there are no further questions, I thank the court.
Thank you very much. Case is submitted.